Hello and welcome to this supplemental edition of the All Access Star Trek podcast. What you're about to hear is the audio from a phone interview with Mike McMahon, creator of Star Trek Lower Decks, conducted by Trek Movie founder and editor-in-chief Anthony Pascal, who's also co-host of the podcast. Tony was only given 15 minutes with Mike, but in that short time they talked about the inspiration for the show's main characters, Mike's philosophy on Easter eggs, how to find comedy in Starfleet characters, and more. So sit back and enjoy.
Mike?
Hey, Tony.
Hey, Mike. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to get into it.
Yes, please, go for it.
So, every good show is so dependent on developing good characters, and I would say that's probably more true with comedies. I don't know if you would agree with that.
These characters are most important in everything. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
So, especially for the four main ensigns, did you draw any particular inspiration, possibly from other Star Trek characters or maybe even non-Star Trek characters, as you were developing these four main characters?
Yeah. Specifically, I would say that Mariner is a bit of a combination of many, many types of a Star Trek character. Just to get ahead of myself, all four of them are based both on Star Trek characters, on myself, on people I know, like a whole kind of mosaic of different things combined, but with the headline being, do they feel Starfleet? Could you believe that these are characters that love exploring and serving on a ship and, you know, would be in Starfleet? And so, you know, the challenge for Mariner was, how do you get a character who's comedically vibrant and causes friction and but still feels like she would fit in a Starfleet? So partially she's based on elements of Kirk and Janeway and Picard, where she knows what she's doing and it feels like she kind of has an understanding of the galaxy and that she knows the rules, but also sometimes feels like she should bend them because she knows better. And it's that intimate knowledge of knowing everything, but then deciding how you're going to express it that makes Mariner feel new to me. What I used to say is that she's kind of like Maverick in Top Gun. Like, he's great at flying a jet, but he also buzzes the tower. And, you know, her story is kind of based in watching a character who knows everything, but who just doesn't fit in, and seeing how she slowly finds her place in Star Trek. And then her foil, Brad Boimler, is partially based on, was his name Sam in the Lower Decks episode from TNG? The guy who's, like, trying to talk to Riker all the time? I think that's his name.
Yeah, I think so. I know you're talking about the guy who's desperately wants the promotion and, yeah.
Yes. I was just like, oh, I understood that. Like, I wanted to take that sort of character but then expand it to a place where I've been before, where maybe I know everything, but I'm so getting in my own way and I'm so busy trying to follow the rules that I'm not letting myself and my instincts kind of, you know, speak to the situations in different jobs that I'm in that would have helped me. Because Brad Boimler is a great Starfleet officer, but he's just so dedicated to trying to rank up, and he's so careful about everything that he doesn't get to be a Kirk, you know, and that's kind of slowing him down, and that's also why when he's around Mariner all the time that he is so, that they have such friction, and even though they support each other, they're a bit of like an odd couple in Starfleet in a way, and they're also not a couple.
Right.
Tendi actually came from when I was first talking to Secret Hideout about this, and they were like, we would love a character who, in the pilot, it's their first day on the Cerritos, just so that we get a great baseline of somebody else's view of the ship. And I totally agreed. And it made me realize that I just really love writing characters that are all silver lining, that they find a way to love everything. And what's fun about Tendi is that if I got to serve on a Starfleet ship, I'd be Tendi too. There's like literally nothing on the ship that she doesn't get excited about. And having that passion and having that voice of enthusiasm and a character who just wants to know everything and wants to consume all things about the ship and learn and grow in there and who loves the technology, like, you know, that's a perfect character for me to have as an ensign, as a lower level officer, who will also watch grow throughout the series. And then, you know, Rutherford, he's kind of like my Geordi a little bit, like even with the, but not really, which is why he, one of the reasons he has a half visor in a way. And we'll come to know more. The visor kind of is one of the few things that his implant, which kind of bends Star Trek rules, because we all know that, you know, Starfleet and the Federation frown on sort of altering yourself with technology. And that's something we explore with him a little bit more in season two. But I just wanted to have an engineer on the ship that was not the classic definition of an engineer that you've seen before, which I think Star Trek does well, and that he's kind of an early adopter. He loves new tech. He likes trying new stuff out. And he's not a Scotty or a Geordi in that he's still learning. Like, he's really great at what he's doing, but he's not able to solve everything at the end of, like, a 40 minutes because he's not the chief engineer on the Enterprise. You know, he's a low-level ensign engineer on the Cerritos. So, I don't know. Like, science to me is just, I love that science, you're not always right all the time, but you're actually testing and you learn from getting stuff wrong. And, you know, Rutherford started there, but his friendship with Tendi, like, they're kind of the Geordi and Data of the show. Like, watching them be friends and just geeking out over Star Trek stuff is such a joy to write.
Now, just a quick question on him. So the cybernetic implant is a choice. It's not like to fix something. He wanted to do that.
We say in the show that it's a choice, yes.
Just a little bit of a pause there, okay?
There's 20 episodes I'm dancing around. I would say if the cybernetic implant seems odd to somebody who knows Starfleet stuff, then they are not wrong.
Right. Now, you've said that you're bringing back some legacy actors and characters to the show, right, for season one.
Yes.
But what about, like, can we also expect just some, like, random stuff? Like, you know, some kind of just minor characters, Mott the Barbers of this world to show up here and there? Maybe not the actor, but just these kind of characters?
Yeah. I would say, I mean, I would love you guys not to expect anything so you can shriek in delight when you see stuff. But I would say that a real pleasure of this show is that I do love TNG, and it is – obviously, it's a dream to get to work with these legacy actors, but there also has to be a reason that they would be on the Cerritos in 2380. Like, and that's not an easy task to accomplish unless it really means something. So, you know, I would tell an audience, don't expect legacy actors to just be showing up to, like, wave and say hi and pick something up off the ship and then make their way. Like, they're there for important reasons when they do show up.
Right.
Now, the other side of your question, I love on Lower Decks where we can take something or somebody who is a standalone episodic character from TNG and let them sort of bubble to the surface again and get more from them. Like, maybe, you know, because our ship is all about second contact, it just felt very organic to go back and look at the standalone episodes of TNG and of other Star Trek shows and be like, okay, it was standalone for them. But what if it's not standalone for our guy? Like, what if they will encounter characters or species that we might have only seen once or twice, but for Lower Decks, they could become recurring?
You know, I was wondering if this – I mean, there's some jokes that I found were so rapid fire. Are you guys just amusing yourselves, or am I reading – like, there was a moment in episode one where a Vulcan, you know, covered in, you know, the zombie – fluid or whatever looks like Spock from Mirror Mirror, but it was so fast. Like, was that a real joke or am I just reading too much into it?
I would say that we are designing the episodes to be rewatched. Like, I love when I watch an episode of something and I really like it because the story is fun and the jokes are fun. But then every time I watch it, you're finding something new. So it's kind of not my job to police all the little things that we hide in there, nor are we trying to create something that, like, you know, is hard to watch once because you feel overwhelmed, but we want it to feel rich and we are having fun when we're making it. So yeah, we do put a lot of jokes in there and I'm ready to enjoy watching as people pick it apart and find little favorite things that people haven't noticed. There's actually something in the clip we released of Boimler in the closet in the beginning of the first episode there's something in that closet nobody has pointed out yet. I think only John Van Sitters has noticed it. So I'm excited to see people find that stuff.
Now, something you talked about these characters belonging in Starfleet, but so much of comedy comes out of characters doing, you know, making mistakes and or being stupid sometimes. And, you know, and do you feel like there's a challenge there to have these characters be heroic Starfleet people, but make kind of decisions that create funny situations? I'm thinking of episode 3 and, you know, the captain a little bit here. Like, is this a tug of war challenge for you to maintain that balance?
Yeah, I think for me, it was a priority to never have somebody in Starfleet be stupid or dumb. Like, nobody in this show is like Morty from Rick and Morty, or like Jerry from Rick and Morty, who's a character I really like to write. You know, I would say that the Starfleet officers can make mistakes. You know, like, they can have their own pastiche of personality that causes them to want things that are not what other characters would want, you know? And so we do have, you know, we don't have as much interpersonal conflict as much as we have people who are excited and focused on different things, and that kind of gets in the way of each other. Also, because this is the Cerritos and not the Enterprise, I wanted the human beings to feel human. You know, Q is always testing humanity to see if we have what it takes. And most of the time, humanity is found to be worthy because we have emotions. It's what, you know, it's what Data is always wanting about us. It's what Spock was always grappling with. And so having characters that have real emotional texture to them is something that feels hand in hand intrinsic with the experience of watching Star Trek. You know, like, for every episode where they're going to a morality play type planet, there's also an episode where Worf is demanding an honorable death because he broke his back. It's like, no, man, right. Just get the back healed. Like, let's go. So yeah, I think that to find the comedy in these characters and their relationships with each other, we're never leaning on them being stupid or being mean-spirited. Like, really, it's coming from them loving each other and how much you can drive people around you crazy when you love them. Because last time I checked, I love everybody in my family, and they're constantly driving me crazy. But at the end of the day, we're all supporting each other. So, you know, Starfleet ships are like a family. So it's a pretty easy one-for-one, you know, sort of comedic point of view for me to draw.
That brings up something that maybe was my biggest surprise, is this show feels kind of like a, don't take this the wrong way, a traditional family sitcom. I mean, it is literally, there is a literal family with the captain and Mariner. And, you know, is this a theme of the show? Is family a theme? Are you, you know, do you see it as a kind of family sitcom in a way?
You know, it's interesting because it sort of straddles the line. Sometimes it feels like a family sitcom. Sometimes it feels like a workplace comedy. To me, the way that I kind of distill that all into one focused area is the B stories from TNG. That the A stories from TNG always had the same sort of, you know, Star Trek exploratory mysterious tone, but the B stories got to be a bunch of different stuff. Sometimes it was workplace stuff. Sometimes it was family stuff. Sometimes it was romance and dating. You know, sometimes it was little mysteries. Sometimes it was comedy. And all I've tried to do is everything that you could do in a B story in TNG, I've tried to grow, and those are our A stories. And my favorite things about TNG were the elements of the crew feeling like a family and that they were all working together and that they were extremely good at what they did. So the Cerritos crew is the same. They're just not as functional of a family.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I guess that's all we've got. I could talk to you forever, but maybe next time.
I could talk about it forever too, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for making time.
Thank you.
All right.
And that's Anthony's interview with Mike McMahon. Check out a new episode of the All Access Star Trek podcast this Friday, which will include our review of episode 2 of Lower Decks. And look for more supplementals featuring interviews like this in the future. Thanks for listening.